Can I ask the panel to be seated, please? It is my pleasurable duty to introduce Desiree McGraw. And Desiree is the executive director of the Jean Sauvé Foundation at McGill. And she has a long history in the business of environmental issues, including being a student representative on the Canadian delegation to the Rio Conference in 1992. She's very young. So, Desiree, you have a pinch hitter.
Yes, that's my understanding. Thank you very much. Thank you, Bob. I had the opportunity and the honor, really, to work with Bob Slater, who was largely responsible for the success of the Canadian delegation in Rio at the Earth Summit in 1992. So it's an honor for me to be here today and to have been asked to moderate this closing panel of this tremendous conference regarding new ways of thinking about water. So what I will do is I will introduce, I'll sort of lay out some of the ground rules, and then I'll introduce the speakers in turn. We've already worked out in advance based on the topics what would make the most sense in terms of order. Each speaker will be given 8 minutes, or I'll give you an 8-minute warning, up to 10 minutes, to present their views on this topic. Some of the issues that they've been asked to address or think about in their remarks are, why are long-term core issues such as water difficult to get onto the political agenda in the absence of a crisis? Should Canadians develop a new way of thinking about water? Is there an impending water crisis in Canada? If so, is there a need for a pan-Canadian water strategy? What are the different perspectives? So very much looking forward to not only the panelists' remarks, but a discussion. We look forward to a lively discussion. So what we'll do is I will start, based on the order agreed in advance, we'll start with Tim Morris, who's program officer for Freshwater Resources Protection with the Walter and Gordon Duncan Foundation. And you can read more about his work in the program. So I'd like to turn things over to Tim Morris.
Thank you, Desiree, and thanks a lot to the McGill Institute for organizing such a wonderful event. It's certainly great to see that they've identified water as a key public policy issue and ripe for discussion. Now, I have to confess, it's a little bit of a daunting task to talk about new ways of thinking about water following 20 of the leading Canadian experts have already said everything there is to say about water issues. So luckily, when I was preparing for the conference, I decided I wasn't going to talk about new things. I was going to talk about an old concept, but one that I think is kind of essential for any progress on a new water strategy approach and for implementing some of the great new ideas that people have had. That concept is a very complicated one. It's called accountability. For me, it kind of comes back to an old adage that my grandmother used to use. And she used to say, grandson, actually, she used to call me Tim. She didn't call me grandson. She used to say, Tim, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. And what I mean by that is we actually have a lot of very good water policies on the books. You know, good water policies, good laws. But the problem is they're not being effectively implemented or enforced. And I think this touches on a number of things that people have already said today. So, in fact, if our water policies were puddings, I think they do very well on presentation, but a little bit lousy on the taste test. Now, don't get me wrong, there are definitely things to be optimistic about, and I think it's important to stay optimistic, as Rob said. We heard this morning the opinion polls, Nick Nanos talking about the fact that Canadians consider water to be our most important natural resource. And that's really quite significant. Also, something that's not been said today is that actually more than half of our provinces and territories now have their own water strategies. So we're in Quebec. Quebec has something called National Water Policy. Alberta has its Water for Life strategy. And BC has something called its Living Water Smart Plan. And in fact, new strategies are in development in the Northwest Territories, in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. And then we just heard the good news that the Council of Environment Ministers has developed its own strategic water agenda. And in the throne speech of the last federal government, they committed to bolstering what's called their Action Plan for Clean Water, which used to be their National Water Strategy. And then something I think David is hopefully going to touch on here is the private sector has now identified new water technologies and using water efficiency as a key business opportunity. And something that's been mentioned a couple of times is that Ontario is looking to make this connection between environment and economy, which it did with its Green Energy Act, in water. So very recently the Premier announced it would be developing a new Water Opportunities Act. So it feels like, a little bit like Rob said, the stars are aligning, right? It seems like water's never been higher on the public or political agenda. And yet our scientists, folks like David Schindler, and many of our local communities are telling us that our water resources are not getting better. They're actually getting worse. And last week there was a poll from RBC and Unilever, conducted by Ipsos Reid, that said two-thirds of Canadians believe the conditions in our lakes are getting worse. And I think their concerns are justified. We saw the image of Lake Winnipeg last night from David Schindler. It regularly now has an algal bloom the size of Prince Edward Island, something that Maclean's called a toxic pea soup. This is something that's also familiar to Quebec, which has really been struggling with problems of blue-green algae in many of its own major water lakes. And also we're seeing worrying evidence that the Great Lakes are backsliding a bit again. Certainly Lake Erie, which is kind of the canary in the coal mine for the other lakes. Some may recall in the 1960s, Lake Erie was declared to be a dying lake. And there's troubling signs it may be returning to those kinds of conditions again. And it's not just our lakes. We've heard about the South Saskatchewan River that crisscrosses the prairies, and the fact that in that river there's more water allocated for human uses than even exists within the river. And in some places, this means the river comes very close to running dry. There's also the troubling fact that one in six of our First Nations communities suffer boil water advisories. And nationally, we have a $31 billion water and wastewater infrastructure deficit, something that Stephen talked about a little bit. And then just to compound things, we have this problem with climate change. And as a number of people have said, climate change impacts are going to be felt through water. And so the problems I've just described and that others have described as well, they feel like they're just the tip of the iceberg. So what's happening here? I mean, these are really troubling trends for a country that's regularly described as water rich, and it looks like it has progressive policies. What I think is happening is that we have some good water policies, but as I said at the top, they're not being effectively implemented. On the last panel, they talked about the 1987 federal water policy. That water policy was a world leader. It was ahead of all the other countries. And yet in the early 1990s, the policy was essentially shelved. And since that point, there's been a steep decline in federal interest in water. As a result, provinces started to pick up the weight that the federal government had left behind. And so we have the Alberta Water for Life strategy, for example. Again, it won global plaudits, and I think it even won some world awards. And yet critics say today it's undermined by a lack of legal foundation, too heavy reliance on voluntary compliance, and also inadequate funding and capacity support, something that plagues many of our water policies. So what it seems like we've had are these waves of really high sort of political interest in water, but the real problem has been with sustaining momentum and getting follow-through on what I think are well-intentioned promises. So one prescription for what people might call an implementation deficit is to enhance accountability. And there are three key ways where I think this could make a difference. The first is accountability to our watersheds and our ecological systems. And so the concept here is really simple, right? If your water policy is aiming to protect and conserve the watersheds, surely your performance metric has to be the actual conditions in our rivers, lakes, and aquifers. And yet, based on the information currently available, except perhaps in Newfoundland, because it sounds like they developed a neat new website, it's not possible for anybody to really gauge in a comprehensive way the health of Canada's watersheds. And in fact, most water policies are not designed to generate this information. Now, contrast this to other countries, Australia, South Africa, the European Union, where they have these comprehensive but easily communicated rating systems. And a great example, actually, is South Africa's River Health Program. I'd encourage you to get on Google and look up this website, because you'll be shocked at the quality and comprehensiveness of the information. And they use one of these things that it's a simple sliding scale. So they rate their rivers natural, good, fair, or poor, and then they publicly report on these conditions. So one of the things our governments could do, and perhaps it's through CCME, is to coordinate to produce annual watershed or river health reports that actually demonstrate to Canadians whether policies are working or not. Okay, the second one is accountability to citizens. Providing accessible information is clearly a necessary part of accountability, but it's not going to be sufficient. We have to engage the public in decision-making processes. And the last panel talked quite a bit about how government can do this through stakeholder engagement and shared governance. But I think also we, as non-government actors, have a critical role to play here. Because one of the things I think we don't have yet in Canada is kind of a strong movement that is engaging citizens and raising awareness about the importance of policies to their enjoyment of water. And this citizen movement has actually been a central driver in major reforms in other countries. Now, fortunately, there's a lot of scope for engagement and rich public debates around water because people connect with water, right? It really means something to them. And they connect with it in some really interesting and different ways. So it might be fishing on your favorite stream or growing crops to make a livelihood, or it might be the spiritual values that are so important to our Indigenous communities, and I hope Mary will have a chance to talk about that. So finding ways to connect with these different values at a community level and then providing tools that empower citizens is essential for strengthening accountability. The third and final piece I want to talk about is an economic accountability. And I don't need to spend a lot of time on this because people have already talked about it. But it's critical, I think, that we understand water's role in the Canadian economy. And my guess, it's only a guess because we don't have the studies to show it, is that water is much more important to our economy than anybody really realizes. Certainly, it's a critical input for most of our major industries and also for other economic activities like agriculture and tourism. And then the other piece of this is finding ways to internalize the externalities. So those situations where we have pollution or depletion, but the cost of those things are not being incorporated into our economic decisions. And again, we have good examples from the European Union, Australia, and Stephen Renzetti talked a bit about this. So just to wrap up, one of the other questions that we were asked is, does Canada need a pan-Canadian water strategy? And my answer to this would be, yes, I think we do, for many of the reasons talked about today. We need to address jurisdictional fragmentation. We need common standards and guiding principles and a vision. Again, Rob talked about that. We also need a level playing field for our businesses and equity for our communities. But in order to avoid the same implementation deficit that has plagued our water policies for the last two decades, we would need the strategy to be founded on a bedrock of accountability. That's accountability to the watershed, to our citizens, and in our economic decisions. So I'll leave it at that. I'm already over time. Sorry. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Just a little over. That's pretty good wrapping everything up quickly. Our next speaker is David Brooks. I think it's safe to say he's one of the country's leading experts on water. He currently serves as senior advisor on freshwater issues at the Friends of the Earth Canada. And prior to that, he served for a long time at the International Development Research Centre here in Canada as director or acting director for Environment and Natural Resources Management. He's had a long career dealing with water issues, and I believe he'll be looking at talking about a Canadian study dealing with full soft path methodology to specific economies and specific geographic settings, one which looks at sustainability as a bottom line versus economic efficiency. So, David Brooks.
Thank you very much, Desiree. Tim, I have to take a slight exception to what you said. You started off saying that everything had been discussed about water, but you hadn't mentioned water soft paths. I don't think they've been mentioned before, so that's my topic. What on earth are water soft paths? Well, the short answer to that is they're a form of water management that puts its emphasis on resolving supply-demand problems by reducing demand rather than increasing supply. But we can get a little more sophisticated than that. It's no coincidence that the terms soft path, whether applied to energy or water or some other commodities, and sustainable development came up at the same time. We've known for a long time, and it goes back, you know, environmental economics is not a new branch of economics. It goes back to the turn of the previous century. We've known for a long time that economic activities affect our environment. What we learned and really came home with the Brundtland Report was that what we do with our environment affects our economies. And I think this was best said by Margaret Atwood when she said, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. The problem with sustainable development, or a soft path, is you can't get there from here, and certainly not the way we're going. Conventional economic analysis has been superb at telling us how best to use resources in order to get the most out of them, how to allocate resources. It has generally failed in telling us how much of our resources we can use. And that's where soft paths step in. Soft energy paths, water soft paths, are respectively the energy and the water components of a sustainable society. And as such, they have three dimensions, one of which I'm going to emphasize, but all soft paths have three dimensions. First, they're a vision of a different kind of society, a society you want to move toward, and therefore a soft path, as the word implies, has a movement. It's much more a process than a product, or as I like to describe it, more a verb than a noun. Secondly, they are an analytic method. They're a way of looking at way you handle resources. And I would maintain it's a method that is just as rigorous as conventional cost-benefit analysis. And finally, they're a planning tool. They're a way for people making decisions to evaluate new investments, new policies, new development projects. Now, I'm going to shift at this point and talk mainly about the middle aspect, water soft paths as analysis, because that's what we've really been involved in. And I'm put a slide up. I'm not going to talk to that slide because I don't have enough time, but you can all multitask. After all, we're modern people, and I'll let you just go ahead and look at it while I go on and talk. Now, you do have to understand, of course, that the notion of efficiency or demand management in water is not new. Engineers and planners have always thought about how much water it takes to do something and whether we can be more efficient in our use of water. But as commonly used, that approach has two critical deficiencies. One, it's based on the same decision-making criteria as conventional economics, which means it does not take sustainability into account in either the water supply end or the waste disposal end. And secondly, as some of Karen Baker's work and Catherine Furlong's work done at the Center for Governance, it's mainly been used by water planners. Say, okay, We'll cut back a little bit, but we'll get the next supply project online pretty soon, and then you won't have to conserve anymore. Water soft paths don't do it that way. For water soft paths, sustainability is the bottom line, not economic efficiency. And this is how we build them from the start. Now, it did take the soft water soft paths emerged from the soft energy path, which was created two decades earlier. And it took some adaptation to get it from energy to water. There are a lot of similarities, but many differences. And I'm happy to say that the Canadian studies were really the first done anywhere in the world where we took specific geographic areas, real physical, living, breathing economies or societies, and applied water soft path analysis to them. The results are available. We have them available in a brochure that looks like this. Or I hope you will all go and brush out from here. You can get to the bookstore in just a few minutes, or after you listen to Bob Slater, of course. And, you know, you can buy a copy of the book and hear about it here in much, much more detail, and also about some other countries that are experimenting with them. Let me go on to, see, what do I do to move this up now, sir? How do I move this?
This button right here.
Okay, just go down. That's where I want to end up. These are some of the results from our studies. And again, I'm not going to speak to this slide. I just want to make sure that it's you can see that some of the conventions. I just want to now generalize, go quickly to the kinds of results and generalize from some of these specifics to tell you what we learned. First, water soft path analysis is feasible. Yes, there are enormous statistical difficulties to overcome, and I guess what are called in the literature heroic assumptions, there are plenty of them. But so are they in conventional analysis. So yes, it is feasible to do soft path analyses on specific geographic areas, specific communities. Second, and more important, the potential savings that you can identify with water soft path analysis are significantly greater than those when you stick with a strict cost effectiveness. If that's your bottom line, which it is with demand management, your savings are highly constrained compared with what you get with soft path analysis. And moreover, because soft path analysis is inherently a long-term strategy, it won't tell you much, if anything, about what you should do next year or even the next 5 years. Because of that, it can allow for climate change, it can allow for redesigned institutions and changed values. Third, and probably most important, as we look at the challenges and what we need to do to overcome this, the real challenge is not technology. We can find the technologies where there are technological gaps. We can see ways around them. But it's really to create a shift in mentality from supply focus to demand focus. Water soft paths are designed from the beginning. You can't have a soft path unless it is sustainable. So ecological sustainability is built in. The analysis shows what we did in these studies, that economic feasibility is also present, or you're close enough to it that you can ask those kinds of questions that were asked in the polls we heard about. Would you be willing to pay something more for this? And if the answer is yes, then these results are economically feasible. What we don't know yet, and what still remains to be tested, is whether water soft paths can be made politically attractive. We're trying it out. We have a couple of experiments going on. But the big question is, how do you move it from sustainability and feasibility to a politically attractive result? Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. You had 1 minute to go. I'd like to introduce another David to provide a private sector perspective. David Henderson, who's the managing director of XPV, am I getting that right? XPV Capital Corporation, a leading investment firm dedicated to investing in high-growth water companies.
So I'll certainly start off by echoing Tim's comment that it's kind of hard to follow when you've got so many experts in the room, especially myself in particular, because I'm a fairly recent newbie to the water world. We really launched into water about 5 years ago as XPV, and prior to that I was always in the private equity side, investing in other industries and predominantly technology-driven. So it gives me a bit of a unique perspective because I'm rather new to the industry, and I went through a sort of a journey to get to where we are today. And I got to tell you, I have many friends in the audience here now, and they all know I am an optimist by nature, so I get pretty excited about things. And I'm very excited about the future of water. And I'm very excited about the future that Canada can play in that continuum. Now, but let me take a step back. I got very scared when I first started looking into this industry because I read the reports like we've all read. I think I'm going to have some of those recurring nightmares tonight after seeing some of the presentations today and hearing about some of the things that are going on. But I got scared, and then I got the advantage as being an investor is we started to look at the other spectrum, that is, what's going on the technology side? What are other solutions going out there? I've managed to travel the world. I've been to China and India. I've been to Singapore. I'm seeing different views. One of the things we did as an investment firm looking at water, we had a different kind of dialogue. We went and met with the big companies, including the oil and gas companies, the pulp and paper companies, the various industries, trying to understand, you know, how they view and how water is valued in their processes and what are the things that go into that process. And what we discovered is there is an incredible opportunity to invest capital in companies that are developing solutions and technologies that create a win-win. And this is really the message I want to leave is, you know, in terms of a vision for Canada. I think we have an incredible opportunity, and it's been mentioned a few times already because the stars are aligning. And in water in particular, and it may even be more powerful than even in energy, is the alignment between implementing technologies and new solutions and aligning with what we want to do in terms of protecting our environment and reducing the water footprint and doing those various good things that we all care about. And so what I want to sort of leave you with is a couple sort of key messages and give you an example of, you know, how this can work and end it with a little summary and how that ties back into some of the work we've done with the Ontario government with the Ontario Water Opportunities Act. So let me take a step back. So we all got these different angles that we come at this challenge with. There's legal issues, there's policy issues, there's political issues, there's social issues, there's environmental issues, there's economic issues. And I think one of the challenges I saw early on certainly was, you know, we all come from our different perspectives and we all come from our position in the corner, and we end up sort of fighting each other, and we really don't make much progress. You know, it's kind of like it's a very Canadian thing, right? You know, we just sort of, you know, nip around the edges and don't come together to collaborate, you know, and find that middle ground so we can move forward. And I think that's been one of the challenges that I've seen in the water sector in particular, because there's a lot of good views, and no view is necessarily right or wrong, but we don't seem to get common ground. And I think what I've seen for the first time is there is common ground amongst those views. And I think I want to encourage that we start to have a new dialogue, right? I represent the private sector, obviously. We're a venture capital firm. We invest in companies. Our goal is to make money for our investors. But our investors are also large institutions. They're pension funds. They're people that care about not just, you know, the returns, but also the sustainability of the investments you're making. So there's motive there to move a little in terms of a more sustainable type investment platform. But the other side of it, too, is I see the opportunity on the political side and on the social side and on the legal side. There's a will now to look at these things, how they can align. And I think one of the silver linings in the great big financial crash that we just experienced in 2008, it has created another challenge in terms of water, and it's created another dialogue, and that is how are we going to finance all this infrastructure? How are we going to pay for all of these great things that were paid for in the past? You know, governments are, you know, they're in trouble. They have deficits. They're running up big debts. You know, so suddenly the old mechanisms that allowed us to do a lot of the things, you know, and the great privilege we have in North America in terms of the water and the way it gets delivered to our taps and all the rest of that is suddenly, you know, in question. And so that's starting a whole new dialogue as well. How are we going to do this? And it's very interesting. You know, you start to look at it, you start to align, you know, okay, well, let's think of the economic issues. So, you know, we've had a lot of job losses, we've had a lot of tax losses, we've had a lot of issues around that. We want to do good for the environment because that's really important. You know, we got to care about our planet. I've got two beautiful young girls as daughters, and I care about, like, what is going to be like in 20 years? What is it going to be like in 30 years? So how do we bring those together? And I think there is a way to do it. And what I'm really excited about is what we're doing in Ontario, I think, is partly a step in that direction. And I think that's what's exciting. And let me give you a clear example. So there's a company that we invested in called EnviroTower. It actually does technology that works with cooling towers. Now, you may not know this, but on top of most buildings, even in Canada, but in particular in the U.S., there's these giant cooling towers They're the second largest user of fresh water behind agriculture. Okay, and the way that process works is we, and typically in North America, we take, you know, water from our rivers and lakes and we move them into a treatment system. We spend billions of dollars in chemicals and energy to pump that water, and then we pump it up to a tower. Okay, and then we add all sorts of, you know, we got this nice clean water that went up to the tower. Then the traditional incumbent technology has been to add a whole bunch more chemicals to allow that tower to, you know, do the things it's doing without creating biological problems, corrosion problems, you know, the different things you have to deal with when you have a water-based process. And then, you know, eventually the tower cycles a few times, right? And you have the evaporation come off. And what happens is the chemicals concentrate, and they got to now blow that concentration down into the sewer system. Then we pump that water back to a wastewater treatment plant, and then we spend billions of dollars again using energy and other chemicals to clean that water up so we can discharge it back into the process. When you start to think about that, that's not very, you know, that's not a real smart way of cooling our buildings. And it may have been, you know, the unintended consequences of, you know, back then when they were designing these processes and all the rest of it. So along comes this Ontario company that develops a technology that allows you to retrofit existing towers, and I think that's very important. Like, it's not, we can't be just talking about, you know, what the future is going to be and what the future, you know, water plant's going to look like and how that system's going to look like. There's a lot of infrastructure and there's a lot of things already out there that if we're going to address this problem, we've got to address both. And there's potentially even a bigger problem in the sunk infrastructure that's out there than necessarily in the new things we're building. So they come along, they have a technology, you can retrofit onto this tower, and guess what? It dramatically reduces the chemicals by about 80%, saves about 10% of the energy, and recycles about 25% of the water in that building, right? You start adding up those numbers. In certain places, you don't have to build plants because that's how much water these cooling towers consume, right? And so you think about what's the outcome of that, right? So here you go, you've got a technology that has a clear value proposition back to the building owner, so they save money. Because it's costing less than chemicals, it's costing less than energy, and in some places now, especially in the southern U.S., it's costing a lot less than water, which is becoming very important. But at the same time, they're reducing the water footprint, drastically reducing the water needs, so that water can be shifted to other uses, whether it's agriculture or other needs in society. It's a much better environmentally friendly impact on the system because you're removing a lot of those toxic chemicals. So it's better for the municipal treatment plants in terms of, you know, what they have to treat and the capacity and all the rest of that. And then the final point is it's great for the economy. This is a little company that's growing at 300% a year in the recession. They're hiring people. They're hiring, you know, high value add. We had a little discussion about that earlier here. Value add jobs. These are engineering jobs. You know, these are high paying, very valuable positions, and so they're hiring these people, and they're growing, and they're going to hopefully grow to be a very sizable company, just like historically we've seen in the Xenons and the Trojans of the world in terms of growing up, and they pay taxes and all those wonderful things. So I think it's an example of how these different areas and stakeholders can come together and talk about, you know, how do we, you know, I think it no longer should be the economy or the environment, or it should be politics or the environment, or it should be, I think I want to inject, and this would be sort of my final sort of note I want to leave you with, I want to sort of propose a sort of vision in Canada in terms of our discussion, and it should be the economy and the environment. It should be politics and the environment. There's ways forward, and we have common ground and things we can do to move this agenda forward and be successful. And I think that's what I'm excited about. So thank you very much.
Thank you, David. As you may know, Merrill Ann Fair has been unable to join us today due to a family emergency. However, the good news is we have an expert who has agreed to pinch hit, if you will. Larry Innes is the Executive Director of the Canadian Boreal Initiative, and I will take a little bit of time to tell you about him since his bio isn't in the program. He is, in fact, a lawyer by training, practicing Aboriginal and environmental law, and as Executive Director of the Canadian Boreal Initiative, he's assisted communities to develop and sustain local capacity for effective environmental management, and he works across Canada with charitable foundations, environmental NGOs, First Nations communities, and progressive industries engaged in boreal forest conservation. He has authored papers on Aboriginal rights and resource development, ecosystem-based management and related issues, and he is involved in collaborative research on sustainable forestry and community-based resource management, and he will be speaking to us about connections between Aboriginal communities and water issues. Thank you.
It's always fun to come to a conference where you're hoping to learn something and find yourself on a stage, hopefully with something to say. But two things have emerged for me, and being a participant up until now has been great. It's reaffirmed that we still, in this country, have a lack of coherence about the best way to manage the water challenges that we're currently facing. But there's a great deal of certainty about the present failures of our federal system to adequately address these challenges. And it's clear that we need a new path. Minister Prentice reminded us of the foundational role that Montreal, this place, played in the history of Canada, and of the foundational role that water, as a network that connected a growing nation, played in our conception of Canada as a nation. But I think if we're going to understand the full extent of the challenge and indeed the opportunity, we have to look at a deeper history. This is Hochelaga. This is the village that Jacques Cartier found in fine form in 1534. And it's also the place in 1701 in which a great peace was signed between the French and 40 indigenous nations who had seen their world turn over with the arrival of Europeans. This is the place where we found the symbol of the two-row wampum, which is, for those of you who don't know it, it's a belt which depicts two canoes traveling the same river together to a common destination. And this is the metaphor of reconciliation, which is, in fact, at the heart of much of our Aboriginal law in Canada today. Because we must remember that our recent history is but a footnote to the 10,000 years that has preceded us in this place. The federalism that is expressed or has been expressed in the conversations today about different levels of provincial or federal jurisdiction over water is not a conception of federalism that First Nations encountering Europeans for the first time as treaty nations would have understood. It's not a conception, indeed, of federalism which is found in our present Constitution, which, of course, has Section 91 and Section 92 dividing the orders of government between federal and provincial entities and the various responsibilities and authorities there, too. But it's also a constitution which has Section 35, which speaks to the recognition and the respect that this country is intending to pay to the rights and titles of Indigenous people and to the treaties that we've signed with them. Our courts have taken this idea of reconciliation in their interpretation, and there's been 30 years of litigation, about what Section 35 actually means. What our courts tell us is that Section 35 is a promise to Aboriginal people in which we will reconcile the pre-existence of their existing societies at the time of European contact with the new realities of sharing this land and the assertions of sovereignty by the Crown. This is not Indigenous law, however. Indigenous law is much deeper. It's pre-existing. This is the law of reconciliation. So it's important when we turn to water to look at these two concepts in law and the foundational way in which our ideas about water are shaped by our perspective. The slide behind me describes, on the one side, Western ideas about law, which have been well elaborated in this conference today. But in Indigenous law, water is understood to be a giver of life. It's understood to be sacred, it cannot be owned, it must be shared, and no one interest or use can be paramount. And it also contains a very important obligation to respect and protect water for future generations. These two conceptions of laws come out of different histories, and they have led to different policy directions which shape the way in which the societies that apply them have dealt with water. Again, this conference has been very clear that our problems around water from a Western perspective are dealing largely with issues of allocation, of dealing with efficiencies of markets in addressing scarcity, on applying self-regulation by users, And indeed, if we look at the last 100 years, perhaps less, of reducing regulatory oversight and shifting burdens from government onto end users. Contrast this with indigenous conceptions, in which self-determination and control over development remain a paramount goal for communities in their dealings, not only among themselves, but with their neighbors, of restoring and maximizing their cultural identity, of maximizing the benefits to the community, to the land itself, that flow from appropriate development, and respecting the idea of intergenerational equity and future generations. If we apply this to the conceptions of water rights that flow from these ideas, we can distinguish between the ownership concept of waterbeds and the exclusive use of water that is contained therein. There's a whole doctrine of law which is being applied in litigation today by the provinces of Alberta and others against the conception of Aboriginal rights in which the concept of a protective limit, the idea that there is a use to which things cannot be put because the quality of life and the sufficiency of one's relationships with others is therefore put at risk. When we consider how these two conceptions of rights and responsibilities relate to each other in water, we'll find that in many places there are conflicts. There are active litigation being brought by the Piikani. Some settlements have been achieved in relation to the water use in Alberta. There is another case that is being brought by the Beaver Lake Cree Nation, which looks at the idea of the guarantees that were made in the treaties that they would have the right to carry out their way of life forever. The government, the Crown, being granted the right to use the land for settlement and development and to harmoniously coexist. The Beaver Lake Cree are questioning whether you can harmoniously coexist on a land base when the government continues to give out thousands, I think it was 16,000 permits, to oil and gas and forestry companies and other developers on a land base that is somehow supposed to also sustain a spiritual connection to a place that people have lived in for thousands of years and a livelihood which is based on the sustainable use of resources. These are obviously incommensurable ideas, and litigation may give us the last word, but it should not be our first resort. So I return to the possibilities for reconciliation. The Western and Indigenous perspectives are addressing fundamentally different approaches to dealing with water management, and they have given us fundamentally different policy directives and indeed different bodies of law on which to draw. So when we consider the possibilities for reconciliation, we should consider the potential of Canada as recently described by John Ralston Saul in his book A Fair Country, as possibly becoming a Métis nation, in the sense that we have the possibility to build on the best traditions in our Western and our Indigenous histories to define Canada in a unique place in this world. And what better challenge to take that up than respect of water? There are places that this is being done, and I put on a slide behind you a couple of quotes from the Northwest Territories Water Stewardship Strategy, which is just coming out. And the process in the Northwest Territories of coming up with this vision was one in which communities were listened to first. And some of the ideas and goals reflected on the slide behind me emphasize some of the fundamental points that that largely Indigenous society, existing as part of Canada's Federation, is putting forward. Water is a human right. Water stewardship must be made in respect of spiritual, cultural, and recreational ecological values. It must respect and integrate Aboriginal rights, treaties, and land claim agreements, and it is a collective responsibility for now and for future generations. I think this is the new path that we should be pursuing, and thank you very much.
Exactly 10 minutes. I'm not sure you had all those slides ready. Thank you so much, especially since it was a last-minute commitment. So we very much appreciate that. Before opening the discussion up to the audience, I'd like to invite the panelists to take a few moments to perhaps respond to each other. We can do that maybe starting with Tim and then moving through the speakers. So, please.
Great, thank you. Yeah, Larry, you did a great job pinch hitting. That was fantastic. There were two things that you said, Larry, that really struck a chord with me. The first was that water is a network that connects our nation. And the other piece was that communities were listened to first in the Northwest Territories. And I think these two things are really important if we want to. Part of what I was trying to say with citizen accountability is we need to break this conversation out of what is kind of a small, so the stars are aligned, but it's kind of a small solar system, right? It's sort of a policy, expert, science community. We need to break this out into the broader galaxy of our communities and speak directly to our kind of citizens in a way that connects with their values. And I'm not sure that we're doing that to a great extent yet in Canada, but the example you gave of the Northwest Territory strategy where they talk to communities and they listen to them first, I think that's a good one. The other one is the last time we had a kind of national dialogue on water that went to the community level was the National Inquiry of 1984 that people have mentioned, the Pierce Inquiry. You know, we need to do something like that again, I think, to get communities engaged on this issue. So thanks, Larry.
Did you want to respond, or should we move to David?
No, I don't have anything to respond on that point.
Did you want to make
sure
comments?
I will be very happy to supplement, picking up a point that came up in a previous panel. Do you get started in urban or rural areas? And I have a very different answer, I think, from what Karen Baker said. I would say urban areas because we know how to do it. We know how to operate, and there are many fewer conflicts. The really tough trade-offs are between areas where water is a source of your livelihood as well as a service and a way to live. There are, you know, putting some bottling plants and breweries to one. I don't want to put breweries to one side any more than the previous speaker did, but there are very few places where you challenge how people are going to earn their incomes by conserving water in cities, but you do in rural areas, including conflicts with indigenous people who may want to use water in a totally different way. And so I would say get started in cities. The savings are enormous, and they're doable in the near term. And besides, they will save money. I do not accept that we have such a huge infrastructure deficit because those numbers come from trying to replicate what we've done in the past, and that's the wrong way to go.
Thank you, David. Brooks, David Henderson, did you want to...
I'd go along the panel and say, Tim, I'm all for accountability, so I think that's a great message. I would certainly agree with my colleague here that any solution to the water challenges we have, it's a combination of managing demand, using technology to fix or address some of the existing issues. It's combining the public and the private sector. So I would certainly agree that I think there's a role to be played in the demand management or conservation. To me, if you define what is sustainable water, it's certainly a combination of these things. And I like the concept of community. And I think something we can learn from the Aboriginal community is that is, you know, this whole idea that we're all connected. And even in this, you know, this industry in this room, it's maybe hard to believe that, you know, when you hear some of the views that we are connected, but there is common ground here. And I think that's something we should take away. And hopefully that gets translated into probably the most important thing to come out of these things, and that is some action.
Thank you. Larry.
And I would pick up on that action theme to say that this panel, I think, is getting to the heart of is the idea that we need to move from vision to action. And the conversation to form the vision and the soft path that David has outlined, you know, has tremendous correspondence with the sorts of values that are reflected in Indigenous society. The technique and the application that needs to be developed and optimized through market forces and entrepreneurship, and finally, the action from our leaders and indeed from our communities to ensure that the vision is fulfilled. And I think if we can create that kind of a system and a dialogue around water, we're well on our way to a solution.
So I think it's what we'll we'll do now is we'd like to open the discussion up to the audience. We won't necessarily take the full half hour because it is a Friday afternoon. We want to give Bob Slater a chance to wrap up. So maybe 15 minutes or so of questions. So I think we've got a couple of microphones, and we'll let the roving mics.
Hi, my name is Lorraine Ederson, and I just want to follow up on the urban versus rural conversation. I'm just a little bit concerned because if, according to what I've heard over the course of these 2 days, that it's mainly in rural areas and on First Nation reservations that we're having a lot of problems with regard to access to clean water and sanitation, I don't know how we can then justify focusing on urban areas, especially given, you know, the state's obligations for non-discrimination and things like that. So I just want to make sure that those considerations are also taken into account when these decisions are being made. Thanks.
Larry or David Brooks?
Any disagreement with that? I don't think there was a dichotomy. It's when you go into the more important, beyond those issues, it's when you start saying, you know, we're not going to allow water for that use. And at the level you're doing, that question never comes up, because you always have to supply clean water for drinking purposes and household purposes. So it's at further stages on that you begin to separate.
Great, thank you. We have a question over here, and any other hands? Just and one over there, just so that our mics are ready to... Perfect. Please.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Suzanne Porterbop. I'm from the POLIS Project on Ecological Governance at UVic. Just wanted to thank you, the panel, and also point to I found it interesting that the Aboriginal water rights was left to the new ways of thinking about water. I would have thought it was an interesting choice to put it in the very last panel versus perhaps as a foundation, with all due respect to the organizers. However, now that we're here, I have a question to you, Larry, and I recognize that you're just stepping in at the end. The new ways that we do need to think about water in the context of your presentation is how we, so as settlers, as governments, as academics, can move forward on this Aboriginal water issues. So do you have some concrete suggestions on, for example, I mean, given that this is a national, what the national federal government could do to help us move beyond this disgrace?
Sure. I would probably start by going back to a few observations that David Schindler made last night, where he pointed out, again, quite clearly in the way that he does, that the vast amount of Canada's fresh water comes from the boreal region, which is still the homeland for many Indigenous peoples. Creating opportunities for those nations to manage not just water as it comes out of the tap, but water as it extends across their territories, and to find ways to effectively address issues around the pace and scale of development, which is driving so much of the water, not just quality, but quantity crisis in this country, would be a tremendous step forward. You know, I do a lot of work with the communities in Fort Chipewyan downstream from the oil sands, and they have no control over what's happening upstream of their community, which is having such dramatic effects on themselves and their environment. I think if they were in charge of how water allocations were to be made, the industry would be regulated somewhat differently, and on down the Mackenzie we would go. I think if we take that type of an approach and look at how downstream communities and upstream communities relate to each other in a respectful way, and how users, again, relate to each other in respectful ways, and create legal instruments which enforce those relations, I think we're on our way.
We had a woman over here in this area who had her hand up, and can I just see some other hands so that we can get our mics over here? Okay.
We can share the mic. Wesley Gee from Canadian Business for Social Responsibility. I think it's great to have someone like David Henderson here, kind of representing the doing side, from the investment side. In addition to all the other great people that have been here. I've got a question for anyone who wishes to answer it, but I'm just wondering to what degree you feel it's important that we look at small-scale, localized approaches to water management, and what might be some of the risks and the opportunities associated with taking that kind of smaller scale approach as opposed to the robust systems that can exist in a lot of areas.
So I'll answer that question and sort of tie it into some of the question rural versus urban. There's some very interesting technology being developed around the remote monitoring and controlling of systems. One of the challenges in managing clean water is it's actually a pretty sophisticated process now to clean up the water to drinking water levels. And some of the challenges we've had is as you move these systems into rural areas where you don't have the expertise and the technical training and all the rest of that, you know, we've had situations where we have these great, you know, technology and systems put in, but then you don't have the people to operate them. So there's a great tie-in happening now around the remote monitoring capabilities, so the ability to actually deploy technology to understand what's going on in your wetland or in your environment in real time. And then that's being enabled by things like the internet and wireless technologies that allow you to bring that data together. And then you can run the analytics and all sorts of stuff, which allow you to operate these systems in a much more automated and manual way. And I think that is going to be pretty exciting for rural water development, because this means you can transfer some of the sophisticated technology into these areas, which can be very, which is going to help supply that clean water. And at the same time, you know, again, you're enabling sort of that next level of jobs and economic opportunity, and that can be tied back into that community as well. So I think there is a real opportunity on downsizing systems. I firmly believe, and my observation is, and I think David said this just a minute ago, is I don't think the centralized water system is going to survive the next 100 years. I think we're going to move to distributed systems. We're already starting to see it, in particular on the wastewater side. That's where it's going to start first in a heavy way, because there's a lot of value in wastewater. We can actually extract minerals and energy and chemicals and all sorts of stuff that we used to just you know, try and treat and discharge in the environment. We can actually recycle that. And so I think you're going to see distributed small systems. You're going to see the actual water, treatment of that system move very close to the actual use of that system, and especially when we start to see the enabling of water recycling reuse, which I think is going to be one of the more bigger opportunities, in particular in North America, in the next 20, 30 years.
I will only add to that, I would agree to exactly this, would have said exactly the same things, that there are significant diseconomies of scale, and I would add the vulnerability of most water systems is in the piping. So the shorter the length of the pipe, the better off you are. And this was demonstrated enormously strongly in Hurricane Mitch, when the water treatment plants were still there, the water supply plant was there. What wasn't there were the pipes.
What we'll do now, I think, is I'll just take any remaining questions. We'll go through them and give the speakers a chance to respond. So there's a woman there next to our last. And then over here, and then at the back. So three more questions, I believe.
Oh, I'll be quick.
That's okay. We'll take them. I don't want to cut you off, but we'll take them in turn, and then the panelists will respond once we've heard from all three. So please go ahead.
Okay. Yes. David Henderson, you mentioned water towers and how technology really improved things there. And that's something I kind of know about, but I'm definitely not an engineer. And so I kind of have a technical question, and I have a bit of a broader question. My technical question is, we tend to conceive water, and we talk about water quality, and we talk about levels of water, but water temperature is also pretty important for ecosystems. So if water is being used in these towers to cool buildings, and conceivably it would heat up in that process, what then happens to that heated water? Does it go back into the ecosystem? So that's my technical question. And then my less technical question is, I understand technology and engineering, there's a lot of science involved, but do you ever work side by side with environmental organizations or anyone else to have a more interdisciplinary approach, since we've been talking a lot about integration today?
So I'll ask you to just hold your thoughts on that, and we'll go to this question here in the front. Yes?
Hi, my name is Jessie Kettler. I'm a student here at McGill University in the IWRM Master's Program. My question is directed toward Larry. If you visit the INAC website, the Indian and Northern Affairs Canada website, you'll see that they've been working on a new law legislation for water and First Nations communities. They have a discussion paper that you can read on their website where they say that the government stance or their preferred option is a combination of provincial laws basically made into a federal law. But if you read a previous report from the expert panel, it says that that is the least preferred option by the First Nations. I wanted to know what your opinion is on this.
Thank you. And our last question, I believe. Yes.
Hi, my name is Simon. I'm a student from political science. My question is about the political attractiveness of the South Path. If you go for supply management, it involves infrastructure, creation of jobs, demand management, again, creation of jobs through new technology, research and development, while the South Path involves changing our behavior. So what are the incentives? Perhaps a big and famous green tax that will destroy a political career, or regulations and pricing. So as you said yourself, South Path seems to give the solutions more efficient, but in the long term, which is kind of the opposite mechanism for politics. So what do you think are the possible solutions to go beyond that, which was your opening conclusion?
Great, thank you. So we have a question for three of our panelists. So what that means is, Tim, I'll ask you to have the closing word after each of the three have responded, I'm sure, because you were our first speaker, so we'll give you the last word. So David Henderson, Larry, David Brooks, and then Tim.
So I'm going to address the question about cooling tower. So to answer your technical question, it actually comes down to the system itself. So under a closed-loop system, which would be the systems that are used in buildings, my answer would probably be no, because that water is actually discharged into the wastewater system, so it's going to be treated through the wastewater system process. So I don't think you have that challenge. The second question, or the second part of your question, was more around what do we? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've become a big believer in. I think all views are important. I think if we're going to solve this problem, we need to have all the stakeholders at the table. You know, one of the things you'll see, we're launching the Ontario Opportunity Report next week. And, you know, one of the key messages in there is we got to bring everyone to the table. We got to find the common ground. There is going to be things that we're going to have disagreements on. There's going to be differences of opinions on certain areas. But I think we all have to extend a little bit of the olive branch. You know, the private sector, where I'm from, has to do it. The environmental sector has to do it. The government has to do it. But I think, like I said earlier, with where we are today, because of the amazing opportunity around the green economy, to create jobs. I think there's political capital to get this stuff done. I think the awareness, things like the internet, making people and the general public more aware of these issues, I think can help bring things along. And then I'm just a big believer in a combination of, you know, conservation and sustainable water practices with technology. We can go a long way to solve these problems, but there is no silver bullet. So therefore, if there's no silver bullet, there can't be one answer.
Question. It sort of goes to the heart of some of the issues in the relationship between Aboriginal people and the federal government. The biggest, I guess, challenge at a local level is capacity. And INAC has done, I think, an appalling job of ensuring that communities have the capacity to address water quality and general infrastructure issues within many communities. So it's an easy fix for them to invoke Section 88 and turn to the provinces and say, your problem. But this doesn't get to the root of the issue. The root of the issue is that these communities are in the process of becoming self-determining in accordance with federal policy statements on self-government. So passing the buck between the two levels of the Crown doesn't actually deal with capacity. And it makes, in my view, a mockery of the idea of subsidiarity that, as Karen mentioned in her talk this morning, that the decisions should be made at the level most appropriate to address the concerns. That, of course, should be distinguished from downloading. where you're left with all the problems and none of the means with which to address them. So I don't think much of that approach, and I think that there would be a better way, but it would have to take some significant investment in order to create the capacity to manage these systems and manage them well.
That's a very good question, and it really lies within that last statement about making water soft powers politically attractive, which is the least well developed. The analysis is, the vision is easy. It's been around for literally millennia. The analysis is much, much younger, but still well in hand. The conversion to a political platform is still going. So, but it's a three-part answer. First of all, there are almost no conflicts between demand management and soft pass. Anything you would do for demand management, we're on the same level with, there's nothing that Steve Renzetti said that I would disagree with. You need those prices. You need the price incentives. That's the first level. Second, there are a lot of things that begin to go beyond the price strategy. Because you want more environment, whether you want more water to be left in situ, whether for recreational purposes, that's a fairly easy one, but for spiritual, other reasons, you want the water left there. And those are trade-offs that are within the political, the ability to politics to handle, at least on a local level at the moment. But you do get another step toward sustainable development. The third step is much deeper. I guess it was Ralph Pentland that said the term sustainable development has been misused, been overused. I couldn't agree more, but I'm not willing to let it go. I think it still has enormous value, and at some point, sustainable development is dramatically in conflict with increasing population and increasing economic wealth. And that's when the soft path really comes, soft path writ large, because you have to make major trade-offs and accept the fact that we're not going to keep getting richer, not getting richer in conventional economic dollar terms, which is also, by the way, for those of you who've heard Dr. Doom speak, this isn't Darth Vader, it's Bill Reese at UBC, who keeps saying, you know, how can you do this? What good does conservation do if people save money and then go out and spend it again? Then it's, but the answer is, less money. But that's a longer term. That's well down the road before we get to that kind of platform.
And last but not least, two more.
Maybe just with a little addendum, David, I think there probably are jobs involved in the soft path approach. In green infrastructure, there's green plumbers, there's designers, there's the new technologies associated with recycling. I certainly think you can make a pitch that soft path is an integral part of a green economy. So I think you do have a political angle there. It just needs some development to figure out what those jobs are and the economic connections. I guess it's an enviable task to try and tie together some of the things that have been discussed today. But one of the things I come back to is what Doug Miller said yesterday about water being kind of a background issue. Because what I sense is that it matters to people, right? It's considered our most important natural resource, but that's when they've been asked directly about water. But it's not yet a top-of-mind concern. It's sort of a subsurface concern. So somehow we have to find ways to ensure that public citizens and communities start to recognize water as a top-line concern. And it probably means connecting it with other top-of-mind concerns like the economy, like energy, like health. I think if we can connect with those issues and then connect with the direct values of individuals, we could see this become more of a top-of-mind concern for citizens in Canada, but then also our politicians, because our politicians look at these polls too, and they realize water is far down the list when it comes to the issues. Economy is at the top, health is up there, climate change was up there for a while but it's dipped again, and water is somewhere down there. Until it goes up a little bit, and until I think our politicians and governments start hearing it from their constituents, I'm not sure that we'll make the progress that we're all looking to make. So I think the conversation needs to go outside of this room and then into our communities and beyond.
Well, I think that's a perfect note to wrap up on. I'd like to thank our panelists for a very substantive and stimulating discussion. Not an easy feat on a Friday afternoon after a very full conference. So thank you very much to our panelists. And I'd like to involve Robert Slater to do the official wrap-up for the conference. Bob Slater.